The following podcast contains explicit language.
Welcome to the XX Gabfest for Thursday, April 6th, the We Want Wives edition. I'm Hannah Rosen, a host of NPR's Invisibilia. In the New York studios, we have June Thomas, the managing producer of Slate Podcasts. Hi, June.
Hey, Hannah.
And Noreen Malone of New York Magazine. Hi, Noreen.
Hi, Hannah.
Now, I know that we all want to talk about the finale of Big Little Lies.
Yes.
We do.
Yes.
But we're not going to do that.
Oh.
We're not going to do that because we're going to talk about it in Slate Plus. Now, this sounds like a promo, but it's not a promo. We are actually going to talk about it in Slate Plus this week. Right, June?
Yes, Hannah. And if you want to hear these Slate Plus bonus segments, now you can hear them free for 90 days. Just download our new iOS app at slate.com/app and you can get all the benefits of Slate Plus for 3 months. That's slate.com/app.
All right. Let's start with our first topic, Mike Pence. Our vice president, a recent profile in the Washington Post of his wife, Karen Pence, revived this 15-year-old quote from Mike Pence about how he doesn't dine alone with another woman. Twitter went crazy. This was more evidence of his sexism, of his retrograde way of being. So what do we think about this? First of all, this is a Billy Graham rule, right, guys? Did you read about the Billy Graham rule?
Yes, indeed.
It did.
And that was really illuminating.
Well, what is it?
Okay. So Billy Graham, the famous evangelist, came up with a series of, I think, 5 rules, but one of them, the one that seems to have stuck with us today and has been adopted by other people, is that he was never alone with a woman. And then Pence has an extension where he doesn't go to any place that serves alcohol without his wife. I'm not sure if that was a Billy Graham rule. I think maybe that's a Pence corollary or something. But yes, the Billy Graham rule is that never be alone with a woman. So the thing that I found rather, I don't know, encouraging or some positive adjective about the Billy Graham rule was reading about how it came into being. So the first explanation that I saw, which I think is not true, actually, was that one time when he was on the road early in his career or his mission, I guess, he went into his hotel room and there was a naked woman like on his bed. And he felt that, you know, his enemies or maybe even the devil was trying to tempt him or, you know, pull him off the path of his religious mission. Another explanation that I think actually has more truth to it was that he was on a retreat with a number of other evangelists, and he asked them to come up with a list of things that often, typically, I suppose, brought down religious missions or evangelists. And they had this whole series, you know, the person who wrote about it said that they all came up with pretty much the same answers. And it was about money and about, various
adultery.
Things. And then, but the one that's really stuck was about adultery and, licentiousness and the sins of the flesh. And so, you know, that's why and when Billy Graham came up with this rule, which he, you know, stuck with well into his 80s, when, you know, the sins of the flesh would have been more of an achievement than a sin. No, but Hannah, you must have had a lot of experience with this rule or come into contact with it a lot because of your, you know, you've done a lot of work with evangelist Christians, right?
Yeah, and I never dine with a woman alone, so that's my... It's one of my personal rules. It was interesting. I have spent a lot of time among evangelical Christians. I spent a lot of time in a homeschool evangelical college, which I wrote a book about. And I would say two things. One, there's part of me that sees the rule as kind of interesting and healthy. Like I almost think of it as the same. You ever talk to people who are in open marriages?
Mm-hmm.
And you know how they're like super honest about temptation and needs and stuff like that. It's kind of weirdly the same thing.
Bet they'll like, both it, love it does those have comparisons.
Like, I know. They both love it. But it is kind of an open acknowledgement that people want to stray and people will be tempted and that marriage is actually difficult. Like, there's a kind of twin honesty. You know, they both land in a totally different place. But there is a similar beginning of the conversation, which I've always found interesting, you know, as opposed to people going in and saying, like, we will love each other forever and everything's going to be great forever. Like, there's a weird honesty to it. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, I would say on the ground, when this rule permeates a community, and we haven't made that distinction yet between, like, what are your rules for your individual marriage and right. do I care, or what are the rules for the community? But when the rule permeates a community, it actually weirdly puts temptation and sex everywhere.
Yeah.
Like, you go into an office, and I remember this from being around evangelicals all the time, and it's like the dude will leave the door open, or you drive in a car with someone and they'll insist that another person come in the car with you. And honestly, like, it never crossed your mind right. that you could get with this guy ever. And then suddenly it's like, oh, you know, is he just restraining himself because he's just so into me? Like, right. it puts the possibility of what's the right word here? Sin, absolutely, in every tiny stupid interaction that you have where it otherwise would not be. So that's the weird twinness of it on the ground.
Yeah, it seems like it sexualizes situations that I would not have thought of mm-hmm. as sexual. You know, like having a meal with a coworker who happens to be married wouldn't really cross my mind that that was like a Temptation Island situation. But in this framework, it, like, that's the starting off point. It's right. it's very I think that's what people find so strange about the rule. It's like you then get this image of Mike Pence as like uncontrollable animal, and you're right. like, wow, really, that guy? And it just I mean, I know that it you know, to them it's a symbol again, and like, someone else's marriage, not my marriage, but to them it's a symbol of the strength of their marriage. But to me, it's like, if your marriage is strong, you should be able to have lunch with a woman and not be like worried about straying the whole mm-hmm. time. You know, that is what's so strange to me. It seems to like underestimate the bond.
Right. And I have to, you know, I just to, as any discussion of this topic, you always have to, you know, spend a moment to say, this is your marriage. This is your, you know, all of that. I'm just going to stipulate it. But the thing that bothers me about it is there's a kind of a foregrounding of ego. Like, you almost say, if you're a person who lives this rule, you're almost saying, I'm pretty important. Peeps are going to be after me. they're going to be throwing themselves to try and take me off my mission.
Right.
And, you know, because after a certain point, it's about people taking advantage of you and trying to bring you down and trying to cause a scandal, and, you know,
like Russian prostitutes putting on
you
know, a show
on you, for example.
common thing,
you know. And okay, now Mike Pence is the vice president of the United States. Sure, he's somebody who people might want to mess with, but you know, when you first take this role, and apparently they took it on early in their marriage, it just feels like it's elevating your status in a way that's immodest and in a way that kind of puts me off that person as far as just on a human level.
But why can't it just be like, we all stray and we're all frail, and you have to be really like a big dude in order, or a big woman, to recognize that there is, you know, that you in a long marriage might be tempted, and that's kind of a thing.
It just feels to me that the rule will not stop that. If you are, if temptation is something that you're going to be prone to, or that you feel that you're constantly fending off, let me tell you, you're not going to succeed in fending it off. If that's an issue, like, that's an issue. It's not about your religious beliefs or your status in life. You know, it maybe it's just time to accept, if you're so sort of wrapped up in temptation and possibility of adultery, then that feels like something else is going on. There's a childishness to it that also kind of bothers me. Like, if you're an adult, you can be in a social situation with other adults. And if you can't, then it just feels there's a huge immaturity to it to me. Like, you know what? If you're in a professional setting, you need to just be professional and not be bringing sex into it and, you know, the possibility of temptation. Kind of what you were saying before, Noreen, like, just grow up.
Yeah. Okay, but I'm going to play devil's advocate for a second.
All right.
I was getting a drink with a friend who is a married woman, quite liberal, and she said, well, my first reaction upon reading about this and seeing all, you know, everyone on liberal Twitter, like, making fun of it, she was like, who's my husband eating dinner with? Who are those bitches? And then she was like, and then I thought it through and, like, you know, he has female friends and, like, whatever, I'll be fine with it. But there is this first, I think different situations vary widely, right? Mm-hmm. Like I'm sure that she would not have had that reaction had she heard that her husband was having regular dinners with a work colleague. But mm-hmm. if he were having regular dinners with, like, you know, an unmarried work colleague, let's say, she might have been upset. So I think it's just the hard and fast ruleness of it that seems odd. Whereas, like, I think probably most married couples have not like quite as clear a version of this, but mm-hmm. they know perhaps that there are situations that might be a little funny.
You know, I have to say, though, that I like the ruleness of it because if you're going to do it, okay, this probably contradicts some things that I've already said, but if you're going to do it, like, do it across the board, because I see myself, like, you know, I don't normally have dinner with women, but I'll have dinner with you. You're like, what? So I'm not your type? Is it something about me? Like, that would be really insulting.
Right.
So,
right.
Like, you've got to kind of be consistent right. about it so as not to be rude.
Right.
What yeah. about the sexism, the potential sexism of it? So the real problem with a rule like this is that, you know, he's a public official. He has women working for him. He hires women. Does it put women at a disadvantage if he makes this across the board rule in his professional life that he can't effectively have a casual social interaction with a woman who works for him? Like, does it put the men and women who work for him on a not even playing field? I think that's what people were objecting to in general.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think it's, I mean, I think that you want to be able to say, oh, you don't have to do lunch, you know, you don't have to do business over dinner, you don't have to do business over lunch even. But that's just not the way the world happens. You right. form bonds with your coworkers, you know, outside of meetings, and you form bonds with your bosses outside of meetings. And yeah, it seems like all the soft ways that you can sort of gain power in an office would be, like, closed off to those women.
Yeah. And it's, you know, we're talking about, you know, dinners and meals as if they're all fancy occasions. But often you're just, like, working late in the office. And say somebody like Mike Pence, who in his work as a congressman, as a governor, not really so sure as a vice president, but almost certainly, surely, you know, there's a lot of late nights where you are forced suddenly to, you know, be in the office much later than usual. Food appears, you know, like, what does a meal constitute? Does everybody have to scatter when food is served? I also think that we should point out that there may be women who live this rule. You know, when Ruth Graham wrote about this rule, much more sympathetically than many of us have, because like Hannah, she's you know, spent time reporting in evangelical communities and, you know, was not as freaked out about it as many of us are. And she spoke with various pastors and so on. And one of the pastors was a woman. So, you know, we also need to remember that sometimes women will be putting themselves in this position and taking on the Billy Graham rule. And that, so although given the state of our world, most likely these important people will be men, but women could do it too. And I'm just guessing that there might be more outrage, you know, that by the men who's like, I can't work for you. I can't work late. You know, it seems like it leads to a sort of a sex segregation that's all too familiar to me from my, you know, separatist days. But I don't think it's really what we, you know, it's okay in a small social circle, but that's not how we do business. And it's certainly not how we should be running governments.
Yeah, I think as an individual marriage rule, you do what you will. I actually thought that Ruth Graham piece was excellent. Like, she brings in a quote from Ta-Nehisi Coates talking about his own marriage and how he has, what does he call it, the gate latch?
Guardrails.
The guardrails, exactly, that he basically follows this rule in his own marriage. You know, the temptation is in, you know, why am I having this second drink? Like, you kind of put barriers in early if you want to preserve your marriage. So you know yourself, and as an individual rule for your individual marriage, or even just for yourself, it's fine. But in a professional setting, it does seem like a problem. Like, Ruth Graham talked to a woman who said, you know, Mike Pence has plenty of women working for him.
Right.
It's not that blatantly sexist that he doesn't hire women in upper level positions, but that it essentially puts a scarlet letter on the women.
Yes.
Like, they're a liability, they're a problem, they're causing issues, you know, they have to be workarounds so that they can work there. So it essentially, it by necessity relegates women kind of not an easy and natural part of the ambitious workplace. They're kind of a problem in the workplace,
well,
you know?
And it probably, if you really think about why your boss doesn't want to have lunch with you, it probably makes you uncomfortable because
yeah.
then he's, you know, you have to grapple with the fact that he's seeing you sexually in some
mm-hmm.
way, like
mm-hmm.
whether he is or not, mm-hmm. it just puts you in that position.
Yeah, I like what you said, June, that actually sort of a mature professional person, like, you know, it's a rom-com trope, you know,
right.
can women and men ever really be friends? It's not like we don't understand that this is an issue, but as reasonable grown-ups, we can just kind of keep that in check, right? Like, even if you're attracted to somebody you work for or with, if you want to maintain your professional relationship, you just kind of work through that, you know? Keep it going.
Attracted to
Keep
people in the office. That's weird.
All right, listeners, if you have any similar rules in your marriage, any equivalent of the guardrail that you put up for yourself, we are curious. Let us know about it. Tweet it to us or email us xxgabfest@slate.com or go on our Facebook page and let us know. All right, our next topic, abortion on television. After years of tiptoeing around the topic or surrounding it with shame and tears, TV is taking an increasingly blasé attitude towards abortion. Shonda Rhimes has worked it into many of her primetime dramas. Our best example is from Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. It involves middle-aged mom Paula, whose doorbell rings and her teenage son says, offhandedly, "Mom, I'll get it since you just had an abortion." I watched Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. I didn't happen to see that scene, although I read about it everywhere. That is pretty offhand. I would say that's like as cash as it gets, you know?
It was very striking that both in Crazy Ex-Girlfriend and Jane the Virgin, which are kind of paired on the CW, even though they don't air on the same night anymore, there were middle-aged women having abortions at very close to the same time. And it was just, it felt like we're in a new era.
And do you think the fact that they're middle-aged is significant here? They weren't sort of like, you know, high school girls who had you know, made a mistake or whatever?
Well, statistically, women who already have children are more likely to have abortions. Like, that is a stereotype on the order of, you know, the welfare queen. Like,
mm-hmm.
it is not true that the majority of people having abortions are like lascivious teenagers, you know?
Right. And
it's,
I wonder if
people with children,
if the showrunners like had that stat in mind as they were deciding.
I mean, both Crazy Ex-Girlfriend and Jane the Virgin are run by women who are very political and very conscious. But I think also that when you have a plot line like that, that in both cases was just kind of, you know, very casually introduced. In Jane the Virgin, Jane's mom, Jomara, discovered that she was pregnant after having an affair with someone who she wasn't in love with. And she's a grandmother and she really didn't want to, you know, start over. She has a young grandson and it just wasn't right. And it was handled very casually. She had a medical abortion, too, which is common in real life, but rarely shown on television. And so the drama of that experience was in her telling her mother, with whom she lives and is very close. So there was still drama, but it wasn't the typical one. And you don't always want to have the same old story of shall I, shan't I, which, you know, again, in real life would clearly be a question, but it's one that's been presented on television a million times.
Do you guys remember the first time you saw an abortion on TV? For me, it was Dirty Dancing.
Yeah.
You know, there was just like, there was just you know, Penny, who's the kind of forward dancer girl. she has an abortion, and that's how Baby gets her big part and gets to dance in the show. And there was so much like, oh my God. She, like, I don't even know that they said what she was doing, because I remember it stuck with me as a kid because it, like, took me a few times of watching and maybe a few years later to figure out what was going on. Like, you just knew there was just some bad shit, but you didn't know what exactly. Like, it was very soap opera, you know? Do you guys remember any moment like that?
I can't. I can't really remember that. I'm trying to think. I mean, I think when I was watching sitcoms as a kid and in sort of like the 90s, that was definitely the era of, you know, like she's thinking about it. Oops, there was a miscarriage that very conveniently happened. You know, that has been something that TV creators relied on just because it sort of got you out of, it's like get out of school free card kind of thing. Like you had the, you know, the wrestling with the moral implications of it, but you also didn't actually have to show your character making a choice that, you know, might alienate some viewers.
I mean, and let's face it, there is kind of a logistical element here of where, you know, TV showrunners, TV writers want drama. They want to have dilemmas. They want to have questions that characters are pondering. Usually the characters in shows are of childbearing age, but they very rarely want to actually introduce a child, because that's just, you know, that's just a big headache as a showrunner. As for making your show, it's just going to introduce a lot of logistical nightmares. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's not altogether surprising that they wouldn't want to actually introduce a child, but there's no, you don't want to keep doing the same thing over and over.
Well, and on Girls, which we've all been watching this season, I think, and it's no spoiler to say that Hannah is pregnant, and the shock there was not the sort of surprise twist was that she didn't choose to get an abortion, because, you know, Girls in its like second episode ever showed a character going to get an abortion, and she didn't actually get it because she got her period. But like the like everyone is very worried about Hannah having this baby because they don't think that she's capable.
I was wondering what we think would be good or realistic for the portrayal of abortion, because you don't want a situation like you had earlier on where it was soap operatic and absolutely full of drama and horror. But you do want a situation where the range of decisions are represented. Like Hannah's decision, she decides to have the child. Maybe in Obvious Child, the Jenny Slate movie, which I saw, it's kind of, it's not blasé, I wouldn't say. It's not like Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. It's just, it's a thing, you know?
Yeah.
It's not a huge big thing. It's just a thing. It's like a plot line. Like you see them actually go to the doctor. I mean, it's a thing she has to kind of wrestle with. And it is maybe slightly more of a logistical thing than it is a kind of moral grappling. But I think probably there's a truth in that. Like there's a range of ways that people respond to that situation. And you want that range of ways reflected on television.
I don't want to underestimate or let's not exaggerate the casualness with which Paula chose to have an abortion on Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, although there was that great line when, you know, her son says the thing that you said she said that you mentioned earlier, Hannah. It wasn't just something that was that she undertook easily. She, you know, she was having problems in her marriage. She really wanted to go to law school. This is a woman in early middle age who has felt frustrated with her career and is the greatest, the world's greatest paralegal, but wanted to go to the next step in her career, and there were many practical factors. So it wasn't that she just undertook it casually. It just was the best thing for her.
It worries me if the portrayal becomes too casual. Mm-hmm, frankly, I, you know, we'll get to this in our third topic, but I do think we're in an era of backlash, and for most Americans, their views on abortion aren't black and or white. You know, a lot of people who are at the extremes on either side do see it that way. But for a lot of people, it is actually this thing that you might, you know, go back and forth on and end up one way or the other. Mm-hmm. And I think that there can be something alienating if it is just kind of like a tossed off, ha, 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 it's so great. I'm, you know, this is how I'm handling this and I'm not even thinking about it. And just in this era of also reproductive rights being restricted,
absolutely,
it worries me a little if that becomes, you know, just like badge of honor. We're going to have a cool casual abortion on this show to show how like boundary breaking we are. I don't know that that's what's happening, but like that, I think would not be a development that's ultimately good for, you know, the way women's rights are talked about in this country.
So the Katha Pollitt book, Pro, talks about this phenomenon. I reviewed the book for Slate. It came out a year or two ago. And her argument is that essentially the right has moved the bar around the language of abortion such that, and Bill Clinton did a lot to help this along, that even the left has adopted the language of kind of moral quandary, so that it's become, you know, it's become a kind of necessary evil, and we all have agreed to talk about it as a necessary evil. And what that crowds out of the conversation is the ability to just say straightforwardly, this is not the right time for me. You know, that's not to say that you feel all sorts of things underneath that, but it's perfectly fine for people to say, this is not the right time for me, and for us to all recognize that as a central part of women's advancement. And I would say that maybe the crazy ex-girlfriend plot implies something like that. You know, it's not like a casual ha-ha laugh line. I think the point they're making, and that's true of Shonda Rhimes too, is that in order for her to get to where she needs to be, both in her marriage and her life, she can't have a child right now. And that's a perfectly reasonable decision that one should be able to talk about out loud, I think.
Yeah, I agree. And I, you know, we should also mention that there was a documentary on HBO it premiered on HBO this week called Abortion Stories, that was a very powerful and very kind of understated in a way portrayal of it. Basically was filmed at a clinic that does abortions. I don't know if it's just an abortion clinic on the border between Illinois and Missouri. Missouri is one of the states where a lot of restrictions have been placed on women's right to have an abortion. And so many women drive hours and hours in order to have terminations across the border in Illinois. And it was a very straightforward, like just women telling why they were there. And it was a great range. There were many of the women had children and just couldn't take on another right now. There were lots of issues of poverty, of just access to resources, bad relationships, domestic violence. And the reasons were varied. It's also a lot of women whose babies were not viable. And it was really powerful and understated. And I think one of the things that some articles pointed out that we read about this current sort of evolution in the way that abortion is covered on television is that one thing that we don't see and we still don't see are the ways that these restrictions affect women. You know, the fact that you have to take 2 days driving backward and forward, that the things that the pro-life movement is doing these days cause huge impediments to women taking advantage of their constitutional right. And that sort of thing is very rarely portrayed, partly again because of the logistics of television. Like, everything is speeded up. And what these restrictions do usually is slow things down. And that is just something that's very hard for scripted shows to take on.
You know, so Carol Sanger's book about abortion, which just came out, which my friend Margaret Talbot reviewed in The New Yorker, is amazing on this topic. Just the day-to-day of these increasing restrictions, how paternalistic they are, the notion that women have to look at a sonogram because they don't actually understand what kind of decisions they're mm-hmm. making, the way in which teenagers have to get permission from a judge. Like, she really gets deeply into mm-hmm. this world of ever more onerous restrictions mm-hmm. and how they affect people day to day. And it's true that doesn't get reflected on television that much. And so the sort of criticism of this kind of abortion TV is that it's bubble, like it's us talking from our liberal bubble where we have relatively easy access to abortion. But I actually think it's good that TV keeps it normal, like keeps it normalized, keeps it in the conversation, because lots of people watch TV and TV is totally mainstream. Mm-hmm. And so if you live in a state like Missouri or Oklahoma, which has increasing restrictions, like here, you know, wait, there's another norm being set by mainstream television. Mm-hmm. And it's good that they keep that other norm. You know what I mean?
Hannah, I'm still thinking about the Bill Clinton changing the language around abortion thing. And, you know, I wasn't really a political thinker in the 90s, but the safe, legal, and rare formulation has always seemed like a good one to me and a good goal for people on the left to have. It seems to get at a lot of things that we want, which is, you know, safe access to abortion and also to birth control and to sex education. And so I'm wondering why you think that language change or that shift that happened in the 90s was bad.
Well, Katha Pollitt's argument, which I found totally convincing after reading that book, is not that language was bad, but that in the 25 years since that language, the bar has just been moved and moved and moved and moved to crowd out the very simple, this is not the right time for me. So that's become an impossible thing to say out loud or embrace or recognize. Mm-hmm. So I don't think it was, you know, when he said it, maybe it was okay, but sort of 25 years later, it's led to the world that we live in now where just the bar is moved and it's not okay, which is why I appreciated all of these plot lines on television, which normalize it again. All right. Point done. Yay, Bill Clinton. But
sorry.
But, you know, consequences. How about that? Can we land at that?
Our take on abortion. Yay, Bill Clinton. But
consequences.
Consequences. That's where we land. All right. Third topic, do millennial men want stay-at-home wives? This one totally alarms me. There's this survey, it really does, that has tracked the views of high school seniors for 40 years. So it's a real survey. This isn't like a bogus study. It's a real survey. It's just a survey about attitudes, but since it's been going for so long, I consider those real because they ask the same questions for 40 years. It has recently turned up a trend that I personally find alarming. Young men are not that into the power wife. So here's a question that they ask. It is much better for everyone involved if the man is the achiever outside the home and the woman takes care of the home and family. So in the 90s, 83% of men aged 18 to 25 did not agree with that statement. And in 2014, 72% only disagreed with that statement. So what the hell? Noreen, you're the closest I got here. What is going on?
I am technically a millennial. I would like to say for the record that this is young millennials who believe this, not my cohort of millennials. Yeah, I don't know what's going on. It seems like backlash is the word of the hour. These are people who have come of age, probably for the most part, in two income households, or maybe, you know, households where the woman is the breadwinner, or they have a single mom. All of that has increasingly been common. So it seems like they're looking at the world that they grew up in and longing with nostalgia for something they never knew.
I hate that explanation. People say two income households in these stories as an explanation. They're like, these kids grew up in two income household. What the hell is wrong with a two income
household?
I don't
think anything is wrong with it. I'm like trying to situate them. It's not like they're saying I want a marriage just like my parents, because that for the most part is not the kind of marriage that their parents had. So they must be reacting. I mean, maybe it's just like kind of a punk thing. Like my parents have this kind of marriage and so I don't want that. I mean, you know, I also saw some people saying this on Twitter, which is kind of true. Like who doesn't want someone to like take care of them and, you know, pick up the dry cleaning and do all the laundry? Like I would sort of like that. But yeah,
I know. But if the question were if one person is the achiever outside the home and another person takes care of the home and family, yeah, sure. That's a dream I can get on board with, you know,
but
it doesn't say that.
Yeah. I guess that's the problem of a long running question. If you ask the same question over many years, it's not likely to be a particularly woke question. But I also wonder, even
that's a good point.
I wonder if how many woke women would if a question was presented in the way that you just stated it, Hannah, how many people would see an equal opportunity or a gender equal stay-at-home possibility. Mm. I think people everywhere default to a woman staying at home for whatever reason. We should also note that so this study was between 1994 and 2014, but then a couple of days later, the numbers for 2016 were released, and those numbers were less alarming. So there was still a rise in like traditionalism among high school seniors, but it was not as pronounced as for 2014. And so I don't think people would have said the millennial men want a stay-at-home wife from the 2016 numbers. And also, despite what you said, Hannah, it was pointed out that although it has been going on over a long period, the numbers are actually not that great. So that the number, for example, the number of young men in the sampling may only have been about 60 or 80. Mm-hmm. So it is still, you know, there's always these problems with sample sizes. I'm sure it was all done, you know, using all the rules of studies and so on. But that maybe we should put the brakes on, you know, sending young millennials to re-education camps in the country at this point.
But Hannah, I found that really interesting. If I were writing about this, I would have called the researchers who were Joanna Pepin mm-hmm. and David Cotter and asked them, you know, these minute fluctuations are odd. Like they, you know, that's always a problem when you're trying to look at trends like this. Like, why would it change over 3 years? There must be some explanation for that. Like, are high school seniors exquisitely sensitive to trends of the moment? Mm-hmm. You know, it suggests that there is this kind of like latent nostalgia always there. It's always something that mm-hmm. people are nostalgic for because it is a more peaceful setup. It just is inherently, no matter what I would like to think. And so people only feel free to express it at certain moments. Like in the Trump era, obviously, people are going to feel more free to express that sentiment given his marriage, given the signals that are sent out to the kind of, what's the right word for this culture where men have a place and women have a place, which people feel
patriarchy.
Free to embrace at this moment. you know, each in their own place, each in his or her own place, whatever it is that people are always nostalgic for. Anyway.
Well, do you have a better explanation, though, if this one is displeasing to you? Like, is there any way in which this is not a reaction, you know? Or, I mean, there has been in the sort of Trump era and the lead up to the Trump era, this resurgence of like men's rights groups, mm-hmm. which is obviously sort of, to my mind, a like lashing out. Is it part of that? Like, what are reasonable explanations for this?
It is part of that, and I think that is extremely real. I think whether you want to call it a backlash or the kind of cultural resistance to the rise of women or the sense that now people are free to express, the sense that men feel frustrated at women kind of owning lots of spaces that men used to own in different ways in different classes, I think that is extremely real. And I think that Trump's ascendance has allowed that to flourish and express itself, sometimes in really, really ugly ways, like in the men's rights movement, which is fairly violent and has close links to domestic abuse, which people have written about, but sometimes not in violent ways, sometimes in just ways that are nostalgic, you know? Like you said, Noreen, like, I would like a wife. Like, I would mm-hmm. like for sure. a wife who would be home and taking care of my kids and, you know, that dinner would be ready mm-hmm. and I would not have to come home and scramble and make dinner. Like, I really would. Mm-hmm. I honestly would like a wife. And so I think everybody would like a wife. Yeah. And so I think when you honestly answer a question like this or feel the freedom to honestly answer a question like this, that's the answer you're going to get, you know?
Yeah, but with high school kids, it's not grounded in the reality of, like, they've never done the thing where they go to work and then they run an errand after work and they come home and then it's like 9 o'clock and they haven't made dinner. Like, they haven't grappled with that. To them, they're just like living in a vacuum and they're like, what's my dream? My dream is like, and so for a while it was this very utopian, like, we will, you know, share duties together way back in 94. And now the dream is like, you know, apron kind of picket fence situation.
I mean, I guess I have two theories. One is that it's easy for me to say that the two-income household is fine because it's not fine for a lot of people. Like, mm-hmm. it's stressful mm-hmm. and people work really hard or they work double shifts or whatever. So mm-hmm. I think idealizing the double shift household, the two-income household, people don't like it. You know, it's like stressful and it's too much work and your parents' attention is scattered and it doesn't seem nice. So I think that's definitely a thing. And then kind of the broader, more philosophical thing is I do think, you know, we say the word backlash. The problem with the word backlash is that it's temporary. It's mm-hmm. like a wave that comes and goes. Whereas I think the underpinning of the backlash right now is this tribalism, you mm-hmm. know, mm-hmm. this sense that we have to return to a post liberal era where we have to recognize that each tribe has its place, like ethnicities, genders. That's the kind of real alt-right philosophy that drives so much of this. Mm-hmm. And I can't tell how deeply rooted or real that is, or how much it appeals to people, or how long it will last. But it's a thing out there.
You know? Not to get too personal, but you have at least one teenage son. Do you see any of this in him, or because having grown up in an egalitarian household, does he reject that in his attitudes, or does he embrace it?
Oh my God, I wish I had asked him. I never thought of that. He once said something so insulting to me. It was a few years ago when he was younger. He was really young then. Oh my God, I should not even admit this. It's so insulting. But he was like playing house. This is a thing no mother likes to say. He was like playing some kind of game. And it was like his babysitter, our beloved babysitter of many years. This is when he was younger. She's not our babysitter anymore. And he had her play the mom role. And he was like, well, you just don't like to do the mom things. And I was like, what the fuck? Like, you know, I'm sure lots of working mothers have that like painful story. Luckily, I only have that one painful story. So it might be that he doesn't like it, but I will ask him and report next week. I never thought to ask him what he thinks about this. Like if he got married, he always says he's not going to get married. So maybe that's already the insult. I got my answer there. But I'm going to ask him and report next week, like, if you had a wife, how would you want to have your household arranged? You know, there must be some strain of millennial men, and he's not a millennial, I guess, but there must be some strain of millennial men that are like, let my wife work, you know?
I think my age group, the sort of older millennial men, anecdotally, I think they are like very into that idea.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Well. It takes all kinds. Last question. So,
we should end every segment that way. It takes all kinds.
It takes all kinds. What would if you were dating someone, Noreen, and you knew they answered yes to that question, that they preferred that arrangement?
Deal breaker.
Really?
Yeah.
All right.
I like my job.
I know, when it comes down to the practical question, so you'll be giving up your job, like, hell no. But if it's just like, wouldn't it be great if only one person would work? Like, sure, it would be great. But when it's so, what in the practical nature, in the practical realm, what does that mean? No way.
Yeah.
Yeah, the person I didn't marry before I married David was, the reason I didn't marry him was because I sensed that he, in his heart, answers yes to this question. Oh, like, just in the way he talked about life or his mother. I just knew that, like, he thought women working was cute. Do you know what
Ooh,
I mean?
Yeah.
Like, he didn't say anything like that ever. And he was, you know, totally into it. I was, like, just starting to be a writer, and he was totally into it. But I could just tell that he thought, like, it was make-believe. Like, in the way some people talk about their moms, you're like, their jobs are make-believe. They're uh-huh. not real.
Yeah. Well, you made the right choice.
Good call.
Good call. Exactly. Thank you, David. All right, let's move on to our recommendations. Noreen, what do you have today?
I was on a plane recently and watched a movie that I probably wouldn't otherwise have watched. I watched it a lot when I was younger and really loved it, but hadn't seen it in decades. My Best Friend's Wedding. Great movie. If you haven't seen it in a long time.
Is it the Julia Roberts movie?
It's the Julia Roberts movie where she tries to break up her best friend's wedding. The best friend is marrying a 20-year-old Cameron Diaz, who's like a, you know, a billionaire heiress. And it's just really great. We talked a few episodes ago about, you know, rom-coms with unhappy endings. Mm-hmm. I don't think I'm really spoiling anything to say that things don't go that well for Julia Roberts in the end. But I loved it. It was sort of a realistic assessment of how this situation would have gone. It did not try to cover, like, oftentimes in rom-coms, people act crazy, and mm-hmm. that's not acknowledged that they're acting like a crazy person, and it's outside the bounds of regular society. And at every step, there were characters, you know, Rupert Everett's character is kind of like, no, you are, this is not going to go well for you. You're crazy. This is, don't do this. So if you haven't seen that in a long time, rewatch it. Also, her clothes are weirdly great, with the exception of one baggy suit. But the
that would be the one outfit that I would like.
But mid-90s style has come back around. So yeah, My Best Friend's Wedding.
It really pleases me to think of you like on an airplane settling in and watching like a good rom-com. Seems like such a happy place.
I just want to note too that it's the second recommendation of a movie that's been watched on the airplane in the last month or so.
From me?
No,
because I would have Mad Max, and it was so freaking stressful, like locked in there in my middle seat watching Mad Max. It was just like beheading and blood and guts, and I'm like freaking out, and the people next to me are like reading their, you know, accounting books or whatever. It was just so alienating. Anyway, I'm going a little highbrow here. Because really, like, all of my recommendations are, like, besides Shit Town, what have I been doing? Like, besides listening to Shit Town? So let's just caveat it that way. I'm reading this Jeanette Winterson book, which is called The Gap of Time. And it's a retelling of Winter's Tale, which is going to make it sound like highbrow. And it's actually not. It's just it's about a kind of insane jealousy. And a lot of very 2017 kind of queerish characters, and takes place in a fake place called New Bohemia. Lots of intrigue and drama. It's a truly fabulous novel. I really love it. And then if you can't handle a whole novel, did you guys read that Trauma Facing Deportation, that story in The New Yorker by Rachel Aviv about the Swedish children who are facing deportation fall into this kind of unconscious spell, and they stop eating and they stop doing, it's a real spell. Like, they have to be, you know, intravenously fed because they're about to be deported. It is one of the strangest, and it only happened among a sort of certain kind of refugee kids in Sweden. Mm. It's a fabulous story. It's really, really great. Huh. So that's all I got. That's a lot. June.
So I want to recommend a show that I've only watched 2 episodes of, but I found them really interesting. And if it wasn't for S-Town and Big Little Lies and all of the other things that have been grabbing my attention, I would have dived in and experienced more. But it's a series that is on Netflix. It was recently added, and it's called Ingobernable. So it's in Spanish, but you can watch it in English because it's available in many versions. There's a dubbed English version. There is a Spanish, you can listen to it in the original Spanish, but with English closed captions, subtitles. So you don't have to speak Spanish to understand it, to experience it fully. But it is, so it is a Mexican story. It's based there. And it stars the great Kate del Castillo. And she is the first woman of Mexico. That is to say, she's married to the president, the first lady of Mexico. She's married to the president. And in the first moments, not really a spoiler because it's the first moments, she kills the president, who is, well, actually, we don't know if she killed the president. It appears that she's killed the president, but she says she didn't. And he was beating her at the time. So that is the start of, I think, 13 episodes. And she goes into hiding. We learn that she's actually involved with a case that mirrors, of course, a real Mexican case of some people who went missing, probably because of corruption. And so even though I've only seen 2 hours of it, I'm fully on board for the rest. And it's a great way, too, if you want to just kind of practice Spanish or you just want to watch it in English, as I say. So it's called Ingobernable, Ungovernable in English.
Sounds great. Mm. Yeah. It's called Latin soap opera, but mm-hmm. more highbrow.
Yeah.
All right, well, that's our show for today. Thank you to our producer, Verlyn Williams. The executive producer of Slate Podcast is Steve Lichtai. Andy Bowers is the chief content officer of the Panoply Network, and our intern, Daniel Schrader. The Double X Gabfest is part of the Panoply Network. Check out the entire roster at itunes.com/panoply. our show page to get our recommendations or find out what we talked about, slate.com/XX. Facebook page is facebook.com/XXGabFest to leave comments or tell us what you think we should talk about next time. Email is XXGabFest@slate.com, or you can tweet us at XXGabFest. For June and Noreen, I'm Hannah Rosen. We will talk to you again in 2 weeks.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.